quality, coming through for the theological seminary's graduate school of psychology at Gordon College, became known to me for his interest in Victor Frankl's logotherapy. Well, he studied with Frankl in Vienna for a year, and then subsequently he's written two books about him, Logotherapy and the Christian Faith, and the Christian Account. And you're well known to many of you, and I think you're in for quite a treat today, just hearing him talk about marriage counseling. I think you'll cheat yourself, though, if you don't somehow get into that interpersonal world with him, where he becomes a person to you, as he has become to me. I started out in a sort of mid-world of hearing about John Tweedy almost 10 years ago now, because at that time he was the only Christian scholar attempting to relate some of the thoughts of Victor Frankl with the Christian faith. And so with their distance, I began to admire and know him. Succeeded him in some study at Lexington VA Hospital in Kentucky. He had come and gone by the time I got there. And then when I was invited to come to the floor and be a part of the faculty, one of the things that I cherished most was the chance to be close to and to get to know John Tweedy. Don, would you come up now? And I'd like to say a thing or two about my third world with you. Don, when I look at you, I'm awed by your ability to use words. Sometimes I feel a little threatened by, because I'm always at a loss for words around here. But through the months and years, I've come to to really see you, and as I look into those eyes, I'm looking beneath the mustache and the gray hair into
my eyes beneath my mustache.
No. They ain't crazy on me. And I don't think folks today can kind of get into that too. So thank you.
Well, it is nice to be with you all today, and at least with the good turnout, I was a little surprised when they told me that at this seminar, which they invited me to hold forth then, and that there would be some 100+, and then all those 200 might be here. And I thought, well, that's not much of a seminar, that's sort of a very one-sided game, and a whole lot of people against just me. But I hope it will be a pleasant time for us. I'd like to carry you through a few ideas in terms of hopeful, logical, and psychological progression and succession. If at any time we are not communicating, because, as you know, professors are wont to talk to themselves a whole lot, and may be so practiced at that, that in front of a whole lot of people they could be doing that and be not at all aware. So you keep me honest, and if there is anything at all that you would like to intervene and discuss in terms of what I'm saying or what you're thinking, I would encourage you to feel very free to do that. Otherwise, it can be a long, hot day. Now, the first thing I'd like to talk with you about is a little bit about the background of clinical counseling and the church. Then this will move into what I hope is a presentation of the general need for counseling, and why it is that pastors are both the best and the worst of counselors to meet that need. Part of their worstness is their felt ineptitude. Often they do not have structure out of which to counsel. Now, if there is anything that research has indicated, it is that people do not really counsel from their theories of personality or from their structural set, but also that they are not very good counselors unless they have one. So it's a sort of a reserve that they have, and we'll talk a little bit about structure, and then finally talk about a new mood and movement in marriage counseling, so far as I am concerned and involved. So this is my hopeful progression. So let's start off with a little bit of background of why it's sort of an anomaly, perhaps, that Christians, how psychology and the church got together. As you know, American psychology is largely characterized as a kind of a non-Christian, non-religious, almost anti-Christian, in some mind, a bit demonic movement. And this has historical background that makes it make sense. Or as you know, the two chief inputs in terms of personality that made this the era of psychology in these United States were Sigmund Freud and John Watson. Both of them flagrantly anti-theistic in their preachment, and their behavior did not in many ways gainsay that set. Freud, as you well know, felt that most of us here this morning were caught up in a sort of a social neurosis. Now, because we get together and comfort each other in our neurotic attitudes, we do not get much sicker if we stay in close communion, although we don't get any weller either. And he believed that we are really trying to tie in a counseling methodology and our own personal lives in a way that is just self-defeating because we are committing ourselves to a kind of an illusion, or delusion, really. Now, he has been, I suppose, one of the most important influences in counseling in these United States. Much more important here than in his native Vienna or anywhere else in the world. The other guy would be, we would never have guessed it. He was raised in a Southern Baptist home. He was christened by a name that named him after the most famous homiletician in the Southern Baptist Church, John Broaddus, was nurtured intellectually in Sunday school. He was a lap child in church until he was able to go to Sunday school, and went to an evangelical Christian university, at that time very conservative. There he got his bachelor's degree and his master's degree, and he went to a brand new university that was sponsored by the tithes of a pious Baptist layman, and there got the first PhD in psychology in 1903. And if anyone you would expect would turn out to be on our side, it would be John Broaddus Watson. Well, he turned out to be about as much of a bummer from the viewpoint of the church as did Freud. They both believed that we all are marginally healthy, and that means just below the margin, in terms of what we believe, what we hope, and they also believe that the value system which we hold not only is not very helpful in terms of counseling, but probably is detrimental in that point. Now, this is where psychology came from. These are the chief inputs. I don't know that there is more than one out of 10 functional clinical psychologists and clinical social workers who does not feel that there is something a bit antithetical about Christian commitment and the healthy personality. Or at least between Christian commitment and helping a malfunctioning personality to function a little better. So that's the background. How is it that it is still very important to most people who are anxious, overmind, who feel the need for help, to see a preacher? In spite of the growth of clinical counseling from its anti-theistic perspective, in spite of the secularization of our age, in spite of the great anxiety, and there's lots of anxiety, I think it could easily be said, at least it was true 10 years ago, in terms of rather careful research, and I think that there is no reason to believe that it's not true today, that in these United States, one person out of four this year will have such a severe crisis in his personal life that he will believe that he cannot make it unless he gets somebody who knows how to help him. And he thinks of this somebody as a professional counselor. 1 in 4, adults. Now we're talking in the order of some 40 millions of people. 1 in 7 of the adults in these United States will actually seek help from a professional helper. Almost half of them will go see clergymen, or those who they are perceived to be religious. Of these, of this enormous number of people, in the order of something of 15 million of them, about 2/3 of them will feel that they are significantly helped by their contact with you. The other half will go see those persons who hang out shingles like myself, who are perceived as socially accepted and legally qualified and professionally trained head shrinkers. Rather defensively, I prefer to call myself a head spreader. But in any case, about half of that, about the same number, will come to see persons like myself and clinical social workers and psychiatrists, and less than half of them, as a matter of fact, not much more than 1/3 of them, will report that they were helped at all. They mostly will be a bit more despairing because of the contact. So as far as we can understand, in terms of any kind of social research in the field of mental health, clergymen are the most sought after as professional counselors, the most effective, and the most inept in terms of their own judgment. The busier they get, the more inept they feel. They want to get training. They want to get diplomas. They wish they had instead gone into psychology or psychiatry or social work. They begin to feel very lonely in their existence as a counselor. They may flirt with the possibility of leaving the church in order that they may get more training. And of course, irony hangs heavy in this regard, because probably they will be much less effective as counselors in terms of the proportion of intensive training they get. If you give them a 4 or 5 year stint, they may be hard put to be very effective at all. They learn things that give them more distance from people, even though the things they learn tell them to get closer. They learn professional attitudes that make them a bit more greedy than they were. And of course, the pastors also hope that if they can get that extra training, then they will be, with social affirmation, be permitted to be a bit more greedy too. So here you have the state of affairs. There are an enormous number of people who really are crying out for help. And by the millions this year, they will do it. About half of them will seek people like you, and they will be pleased with the contact. Those with whom they see otherwise, they won't be so pleased. And the irony is that many of you won't be pleased, and you will feel ineffective in your contact. Ma'am? About 66%, nearly 2/3, report significantly helped. About 40% who seek other kinds of professional helpers say that they were helped. A series of studies that was funded by on a five-year study by the Congress. It was known as the five-year study of mental health and illness in the United States. It was published, I think, in 1960 or 1961, in summary, in a small paperback known as Action for Mental Health. About six of the commissions who entered into the study also published monographs in different areas. The research for these particular data that I'm mentioning to you was made by the research staff of the University of Michigan, although the sampling, I think, was very good, and as research projects go, my judgment is that it was a very good one, although, of course, a very microscopic sample in terms of the some 180 million of people who lived in the states at that time. Sure.
The two-thirds, one-third, does this mean that does this have a relationship to the one-third outside the Perry administration? Are they dealing with more severe cases? Is that the reason for it? Are we dealing with similar cases?
It appears that there is no special distribution of those first contacts. They are, if not willy-nilly, at least more or less equal. No matter how badly they are hurting, apparently that number of people in a wide variety of symptoms will first seek a religious person.
What do we mean by health?
Health. This is that any person who feels that he's having an emotional crisis with which he cannot cope will seek out somebody who he perceives as a trained helper for that crisis. And he will ask him to help him. Now, it comes in a wide variety of packages. But it's people who will knock at the door of a minister or a clinical psychologist or a psychiatrist or a clinical social worker or a marriage and family counselor and say, I have a problem. Will you help me? And his phenomenological experience is that he cannot survive. Now, he doesn't mean he will die or it will be necessarily catastrophic, but he's feeling that he cannot cope. And so he asks somebody to help him. And there are about five different categories of people in large numbers whom he asks. Sir? Maybe that ordinarily they are free. That maybe that that's the reason for the initial contact. I rather think it's a significant item. They're very available, everybody knows them, although people tend not to go to those whom they know. Well, half of them who go to the clergyman make their first contact with an anonymous clergyman, as some whom they do not know at all. I suspect they feel that they are more readily available, that they will not have to cool their heels in an office for a long time, that they will not have to wait until next Thursday to get an appointment. They have the feeling that they can walk in and that they can walk out of them in the poor economically, and that this will be a good guy. Now, those may not be very high motives for going in, but it's the proof of the pudding that from which the palate makes its vote.
Would they also be endeavoring to deny the severity of their sickness? Is this possible?
Well, I'm not sure, because you get anywhere from persons who have lost a job or who are just anxious about going to school to persons who are really spaced out in terms of very severe and bizarre schizophrenic thought process. So I do not know that there was any particular distinction between those first contacts with ministers. Now, it may have been that they're a hope, that the hope of a person who goes is that he may get a conscientious referral or something. Of course, many of them are referred by interested and anxious friends and relatives. Now, why do you suppose it is that ministers feel so inept about it? The person may come to see them only once or twice and feel very significantly helped. And the minister may feel a bit depressed because they don't come back. They had read that it's supposed to take a certain amount of time, at least a lot of them. And it's while they believe that the resurrection took just a few minutes, if even that long, and that people get great reversals in terms of human behavior on other grounds, they think a person who comes for help and says, I'm kooky, I'm all mixed up, I need help, is supposed to take a long time. So they may feel a bit inept because usually they don't take very long. Very often they struggle with the control of time. I know many ministers who, with heroic and very high messianic feelings, have entertained a person for the first time. And they didn't plan it, but a couple hours went by the schedule, and he finds out they want to come back this afternoon. And his messianic hopes and feelings have not flagged much, and so he sees them in the afternoon. He just goes, this person wants to see him that night. And instead of going away rejoicing, the person says, I'll die if I don't see you again tonight. And then when you get around mid-afternoon, this reversal of attitude, where you actually hate the person. You wouldn't want him to know that, because your facade is not changing much. But you really do despise him. He is such an encroacher upon your time. You may have fantasies about why it was that God called you to this parish that has so many problems. When only 3 or 4 hours before, you had good and grandiose feelings about God's special providence for you and for this person. So the control of time is a very important problem. In crass professional counselors, they look at their watch, maybe more than once, but they look at their watch and stand up. No problem with time there, just stand up. And while the patient may try to get a little doorknob catharsis, and it's pretty obvious what he's supposed to do. And if you want to see me again, and you find that you have a niche in his calendar, and that's when you can come back. And you may get the feeling that those 167 hours between now and then are really 2 eternities. Well, that's when you can see him again. And he may act as though he could care less, or he may act like he's very sympathetic and wishes that he were identical friends. And the other one had all the time in the world for you. But very seldom is that the case, even if he is identical twins. The control of time, the shortness, very often it's this insidious and invidious encroachment of the idea in your experience of how much the guy down the street is getting for it. I don't know what, I guess probably none of you have this experience, but a lot of ministers with whom I taught really spend a whole lot of fantasy time in terms of how they might get paid for it. Somehow it gives them dignity. It makes it more worthwhile. And it's easy to see. If somebody will give you $35 for spending 50 minutes with them, and another person to another person won't give them a cent for spending half a day with them, then that is in itself a kind of a demeaning of the value of time when we live in a highly secularized culture. And nothing is more reinforcing in our society, I think, even possibly to ministers, than dollar bills. Sure.
I think that's the problem with most ministers. I think the problem really is that when they get into a debt level situation and they get to conditions that clearly indicate a real sickness, and they just don't feel that they have the equipment to deal with it.
there isn't anything that a psychiatrist is no bigger nor no better, and he's not standing there with a syringe. And so they get anxious about the interaction with the person and feel that they are not appropriately and properly able to interact with them. I think there are, well, I'll develop in a few moments a schema of emotions. At least it's the feeling of dread that you have. And as I define dreadful feelings, they are either guilt feelings or anxiety feelings or anger feelings or fear feelings. Now maybe that's not fair to a mixed feeling that you have about it. But mostly, I think, is when suddenly you feel very uncomfortable. And it may be that the discomfort starts when a person doesn't make any sense. Like a fellow came in my office the other day, I went out to greet him in the lobby, and he was kind of lying down on the sofa. It happened to be July 1, I think, and it was a brand new intern who came there that day, who was in the lobby, and he saw this character just lie down on the sofa and flip-flop over on the floor and lay there moaning and groaning. And I'd never seen this person. He was, at that point, a name on my calendar. And I walked out and kind of flipped him over and asked him his name. And he told me his name. So I said, get up off the floor. Are you sick? Well, no, he was more satanic. I said, get up off the floor in my office there, that you're making a spectacle of yourself. And I just see people in there. And he galvanized into action, got out and went in my office. And in the transition from the lobby to my office, he wasn't crazy at all. And so you find terrific things about him. You find that craziness, like fear or anxiety, normally can be controlled under some circumstances. Now, the layman feels that kind of craziness is flying apart everywhere else, and it's not a style of behaving at all. And this fellow told me that he was the devil. And I told him that I thought the devil was smarter than he was. And I just couldn't imagine the devil coming in and flopping down on the floor of a waiting room on an accounting center. I just have the feeling that the devil is much more clever than that. The devil probably, if he were crazy, would act very sane under those circumstances. So there's a certain sense when most persons who have not had a great deal of clinical experience, and many persons who believe that you cannot challenge and ask a crazy guy to act sane, then feel the emotions. The second is a view of how persons really function in terms of interpersonal reaction. And thirdly, why one person will marry another. Now, we can know those three things, at least it may be that none of them are true, but as long as they are clear in our minds and we feel good about them, probably we will have the confidence to interact with them in a way that at least is not harmful. First, a schema of emotion. I have developed a schema which I find has been very helpful for me in terms of how to view emotional set. And that is to consider our feeling levels, and that's primarily what stimulates counseling opportunities,
somebody feels in a certain way, and it doesn't, it is not in accord with how he thinks, or how he thinks he should think, or how he perceives the real world, and so you find yourself out of joining. And he has a feeling. Now, I call this generically the feeling of dread. It's dreadful. He feels bad. Awful. I use this as a generic term. The feelings of dread. And since persons are so time-bound, it has been helpful to me to see, or help try to understand myself and others as they relate to these dreadful feelings, as to whether they are perceiving them as related to the past, or to the future, or to the present. Now, they're all present, if the person is feeling it at the time, but very often you may have a time reference to the past. We call the dreadful feeling of the past guilt. Guilt feeling. This is a feeling response when a person says to himself, and maybe to others, "I wish I had not done that. Woe is me, I am undone." Or we may think, "I wish I had done that, and it's too late." So either way, he wishes that he had made some decision in the past which is contrary